And this went on for 7 years, is
well, in my time, I would have been there for 7 years. I was there, as I say, from late October 1970 until, I think it was about April 1977.
Why did you leave?
Well, at that stage, as I mentioned earlier, the Bauer plant had been dismantled and shipped back. The markets were shrinking. The recession had really taken hold in the UK. And an awful lot of the UK mills were, paper mills, were closing or on short time or week on, week off and so on. And it was inevitable that we would experience the same here in Ireland. So as staff were leaving, they weren't being replaced. And it meant that, you know, there was more and more work needed to be done by fewer and fewer people. And I kind of felt that, you know, we can't go on like this. I think with any organisation, there has to be a certain volume of people there to do the work. There has to be a critical mass for things to survive. And if you go below that, the writing is on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Which, in fact, it was, because the mills would have closed. When did the mills close? 1971,
we got our notice.
Yeah.
So in 1981, when you got your notice then...
Well, I had gone at that stage. I left them, you know, in 19...
Oh, yes, that's right,
in 1977.
But, so, are you saying that you saw the writing on the wall and that's why you left?
Well, yes, I did. I got offered a job by one of our suppliers in the stationery business, supplying stationery to other companies, and I was working for him as a purchasing officer for about 3 or 4 months, and things didn't work out.
And who was he?
He was a guy called John Thornton, a company called Windsor Stationery down in Bluebell.
Yeah.
And John had been a supplier, or both a supplier and a customer of the mills, because he would supply a lot of stationery requirements, pens and
pads. Was there any loyalty there? You know, walking out on your own.
No.
Company and or the well, people I mean, you worked with all your
Yeah,
life.
But I mean, a lot of the people who I had worked with had already left and hadn't been replaced. And every time somebody left, their job was divvied up among the remaining staff. And then if another one left, their job was divvied up among the remaining staff. So it got to the stage that not only were you doing the work, your own work that you would have been doing, say, a year or two previously. You were also doing a bit of Joe's and a bit of Paddy's and a bit of Mary's.
But is that not repeating itself today in the public sector, in libraries, and where staff are not being replaced? It's a similar situation.
Well, it is, you know, and like I would have to ask the question. I mean, I know there's an embargo on recruitment to the public service, but at some stage you have to say, well, hang on a minute. You know, is it right that we have so many vacancies for, say, sergeants in the Gardaí simply because there's no promotions, because there's a ban on promotions? Or the same sort of situation within the health service.
Mm.
And you'd have to ask the question, you know, could they not manage this better? You know, and say, okay. Like, for instance, in the height of all of this, no recruitment for the public sector, the last government ceased to be, right? Surely, if there's going to be no replacement of staff or no replacement of people, we shouldn't have had a new Taoiseach. Would that not be the logical...
But
we did.
Yes.
And the reason we did was because everybody realises that you have to have a Prime Minister. But in the same way, you have to have people to fill specific key roles in any industry.
But apply your own knowledge and experience in the situation that happened with staff not being replaced.
Mm.
So it collapsed.
Well, it did, and things that needed to be done weren't being done until they became absolutely critical.
Yeah.
So, like, forward planning of say, paperwork, again, it would have affected me from the point of view that we used to have to apply to the Department of Industry and Commerce for permission, for licences to import certain materials, machine spares, chemicals that just weren't available in the Irish market. And we had a big file of these licences for specific items, not everything, but for specific items. And if it was a case that, you know, a shipment was on the way and nobody had made sure that the license was available, the item couldn't clear customs. And it would be sitting down at the docks. The engineers would be going ballistic. Where's my motor or bearing or whatever? And it was jobs like that that weren't absolutely, that should have been done routinely, but were only being done when they became absolutely critical. And there was an awful lot of pressure on all the staff at that stage, you know. Mm-hmm. Because there would have been, I think, between 600 and 700 people working in the mills at its peak. That would have been none of that. And I don't know how many were there when it finally closed.
Probably five.
You know, but so like it was a huge amount of people had gone, you know.
So living here in Clondalkin and seeing, I suppose you witnessed the end of your own family's business in the post office side of things.
Yeah.
And also witnessing the end of the mills.
The mills, Well, it certainly was.
It changed the place drastically.
Well, it did indeed. And like my father, as I said, he was the local insurance man. And like if ever there was a strike in the mills or in Clondalkin Concrete, which were the two main suppliers, the effect on the community was absolutely devastating because there was just no money. In his job, he found that, you know, the first thing not to be paid was the insurance, you know, because people had to put bread on the table for their families, and that obviously took priority. But like the knock-on effect that it strikes would have had, and also the closing up or reduction of businesses would have had on the greater community, on the traders in the village particularly, the grocers, the supermarkets and people like that, and also on all of the unseen, the knock-on people who depended on having a big local industry, that the effects on that were quite severe. And very often you'd find that, you know, younger people particularly, who didn't have wives and families and responsibilities at home, would up stakes and go up north or go to the UK in the hope of getting some employment over there.
Yeah, it's fascinating, really, when you look at all the way, just in a very short time, in 25 years, that there's been such change.
Yeah.
So your wife, you met her at the mill.
Met her at the mills. She came in to work as one of the secretaries attached to the department.
What was your wife's name?
Cora Cantwell was her.
Oh, where was she from?
She was from Walkinstown. And I remember when her telling me that when she got the job in Clondalkin Paper Mills, her mother was horrified. You're not going all the way out to Clondalkin. Like, you'd think she was going off to the Skellig-Michael or somewhere, you know. The fact that it was only a bus run away. But, like, Clondalkin at that stage, which would have been, I think she started in the mills in October 1974. Clondalkin would have been very much out in the country at that stage, you know. That the nearest towns would have been Talla, Lucan, probably Bluebell in Chicor, and fields in between them.
Yeah.
You know? Because, as I say, it was only in the early 60s that Clondalkin started to get very built up. But even as late as, I think, the late 70s, when the Pope was, the Pope's Mass was on in the Phoenix Park, we walked up to the top of the Monastery Hill, and you could look down, I think, over fields where Woodford and all those estates are built now. So it still was out in the country at that stage. But I mean, the mills, again, because the mills on Clondalkin Concrete was such a big place for employment locally, it was inevitable that an awful lot of Clondalkin people would have met in these companies. And in fact, Nuala Kelly was one of the other secretaries in the department, and Jerry MacDonald, who was one of the guys in my office, they got married. We got married, and then they got married. So there was a big, it was like a dating agency, I suppose. And the same thing applied, I suppose, in Clondalkin Concrete as well, you know, where you'd have a lot of young people put together, that it would be a place to go.
And so, living here today, is it? Are you retired?
Yes, I'm retired now.
And
after I left the stationery supplier, I was out of work for a while, and then I got working for the Gown Group of companies. I was working on the Long Mile Road for Peugeot, Ireland. And I worked in the motor trade then for 31 years for the Gown Group. And I was made redundant then, just 5 years ago, from Honda.
Okay. And tell me, final question. Mm-hmm. Is there... Do you know, every area in the country has its own dialogue and its own accent. Is there a Clondalkin accent?
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. I'm sure there's certain expressions in that would be used in the area, but none spring to mind, I'm afraid, at the moment.
Yeah, I must ask that question. I'll get back to you on that. Tim O'Brien, it's been lovely talking to you.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's my pleasure. Okay.